Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Robert Swofford. Robert is the founder and owner of Strike for Cause Jury Consultants. Welcome to the podcast, Robert.
Thank you for having me.
I was thinking back as we were planning the show, and by the time this airs, we will be past our 100th episode. And I don't think we've had anyone come on who does what you do. And so it's exciting for us. And some people may wonder, well, what's the crossover between appellate lawyers and jury consultants? And I actually think it's greater than people would tend to believe at first. So we're excited to get to visit with you today. So let's get into this. Robert, will you just kind of tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, and maybe where you went to school and how you got to be a lawyer? Because you are a lawyer.
Yes. Well, I was born in Odessa, which is out in West Texas. And I was a kid who talked a lot. And so when you're a kid who talks a lot and likes to read in Odessa, then back then in the 1960s and 70s, what they would say is, well, you're going to be a lawyer like Warren Burnett. And some of the people may not be old enough to know who Warren Burnett was, but he was just one of the greatest trial lawyers who ever lived. And thankfully, later on, I got to work with him a little bit toward the end of his career. But that's sort of how it started. And then was a college debater, went to Baylor because Baylor had at that time one of the best college debate programs in the country. I think still does. And then transitioned into Baylor Law School because I knew I wanted to be a litigator.
So from Baylor Law School, what was your early career like right out of Baylor?
Well, I thought that I was going to be a big time trial lawyer like Warren Burnett. And what he would do is he would do criminal defense and he would also do personal injury plaintiffs work. And that's sort of what I started out to do. But very early on in my career, I got the opportunity to go see Kat Bennett speak. And Kat Bennett was not a lawyer. She was a psychologist who was sort of one of the early inventors of this thing that they call jury consulting. And Kat Bennett had this remarkable idea that was revolutionary at the time. And that was that in voir dire, instead of asking questions that were actually just a speech disguised as questions in order to try to persuade your audience, why not ask some questions to actually find out some information about the individual human beings who are out on the panel? Now, that just seems like totally obvious, right? But that's not how jury selection was taught when I was in law school. When I was taught in law school is that you would essentially ask questions to try to get your licks in first before the other side did. And it was essentially like sort of a disguised opening statement. That would have been in 1986. And to this day, I still see lawyers wasting their time doing that. But for me, that was just revolutionary. It's like, oh my gosh, what a great idea. And how much more fun is that to ask questions and find out about people?
Well, and it seems like the law in Texas has kind of tracked that movement. They really have gone away from talking about the facts of the case to let's talk about the prejudices and the biases that the individual jurors bring in from the outside. So it's interesting that the law has kind of tracked your path in that direction.
Well, so the thing that's interesting about that is that just recently I had a case where I said, listen, I'm concerned about this judge. She's a young judge. I don't let you know that she really understands the law, like the quote unquote new law. It's not the new law of voir dire, but sort of the law of voir dire. And she had made some statements that gave us some pause about, do we want to change something in the motion in limine? And that gave me the idea that maybe she thinks that we should be talking about the facts in voir dire, which you should not be doing. And luckily, on this case, as is the case in many of my cases, we had a very good appellate counsel who was on the team to do the motion practice and protect the record. And so together, we were able to put together a little brief that talked about Cortez and Hyundai, and it talked about what constitutes an improper commitment question and how it's really not appropriate to talk about the facts during voir dire. Because if either side talks about the facts in the voir dire, what would be a proper question can very easily become an improper question. So in terms of the law isn't that you can't ask commitment questions. You could never get a strike for cause if you didn't ask a commitment question. You have to commit them that, yes, I could not consider awarding money for mental anguish damages, or I would absolutely ignore an instruction saying don't consider a person's failure to testify. Like, they have to be committed around that, right? Mm-hmm. But there is something called an improper commitment question, which is asking them to commit on the specific facts of this case. And so none of my scripts that I write for lawyers have any of the facts in the case. And the thing that was interesting about this is that clearly the judge, when I showed up on Monday morning to pick the jury, had read every case. Hmm. And so this is the thing that's interesting is I picked 22 juries post-vaccination. And my 23rd one is on Monday. And some of the courtrooms I'm walking into, some of the judges, especially in Harris County, have not been alive as long as I've been practicing law. Yeah. But one thing is universal is they all want to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And if you give the law to them in a digestible way, they're not offended. Mm-hmm. But it did require the teamwork because I know how jury selection goes and I know generally what the cases are. Forming that into a cogent memorandum or brief such that in a written form, such that the judge could read that and get it with hyperlinks to the cases, because obviously she read the cases, was just a great teamwork. So I'm always looking for ways to team with the appellate lawyers. Because the cases I get hired on are big cases, right? Like there has to be enough money at stake to hire a lawyer and hire a lawyer who just does what I do. And usually if there's money for that, there's money to hire an appellate lawyer, should be.
Right. Well, that's definitely one area where our practices overlap, it seems, is making sure that the court understands the law of jury selection. And then another big thing that happens at the jury selection stage, or what we in Texas call voir dire, which is, for our non-Texas listeners, is a major mispronunciation of the original French phrase, but it's sort of in our nomenclature. It's in our lexicon, as Brian Garner would say. But the other big part of it, and I'll just kind of skip ahead to something I didn't intend to address until later, but you kind of opened the door for me here, Robert, and that is preserving error at the jury charge phase. It is a whole body of jurisprudence.
Yep.
That frankly, because we haven't been trying cases to juries very much in the last 2.5 years, we just haven't been touching regularly. We think back to Batson and all those cases, but what do you see in your work day in, day out in terms of error preservation? Is that something that you pay specific attention to? Say, for example, in the instance when you don't have an appellate lawyer on the team with you?
Well, I handle this, even if I have an appellate lawyer, and they're always really grateful. And, you know, obviously, so the first thing that you have to do is you have to make sure that this is specifically in reference to Strikes for Cause. So the name of my business is Strike for Cause, because I developed the Strike for Cause method of jury selection. So I hold up one of my charts for you, although I don't think your audience can see it, but you can describe for the audience what this chart shows. It is an artist pad with a CD chart with lots of X's on it. In each of those X's, there's a C with a highlighter on it. And the C with a highlighter means that the person was struck for cause. And so my entire system is about maximizing strikes for cause. So one of the things that a judge needs to understand that if they don't grant my strike for cause, whenever I show up in the courtroom and I'm entitled to it, that I know how to preserve error. And so one of the things that's real important is making sure initially that the person has said something that actually gets them struck for cause. Mm-hmm. And so there's a great quote by Mark Twain that the difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between lightning and a lightning bug. And so oftentimes lawyers will ask questions like, well, who has a hard time with mental anguish damages? Or who here would find it difficult to award mental anguish damages? Or who doesn't like mental anguish damages? None of which are a strike for cause, okay? If you ask, who here simply could not consider awarding mental anguish damages? That's a strike for cause, okay? And so in the cases with Cortez and Hyundai, just because someone has a bias, that's not enough for a strike for cause. It's that the bias would ultimately affect how they would decide the case. So it's really important whenever you're writing voir dire questions to initially make sure that if a judge denies your strike for cause, that the judge made a mistake. I mean, that's the first part, that you actually got it. And I've had lawyers complain about very good judges not granting their strikes for cause. And I said, well, you didn't get it. And the judges obviously have lots of discretion. But just last couple of weeks, I've been in a position where we've established a strike for cause. Judges granted tons of them and then probably just gets tired or worried I'm going to burn the panel. And right. They don't grant one, right? And then after we go through that process at the bench, I'll say, judge, I'm requesting an additional peremptory strike. And the judge will look very confused. And why, Mr. Stafford? Well, you should have granted a strike for cause on juror number 7. You didn't for this ground. You didn't grant the strike for cause for number 7. And so I'm asking that you give me an additional peremptory strike to cure that error. And the judge says, with a confused look on their face, will say, denied. And I say, thank you, Your Honor. Then we go back and we do our peremptory strikes. And I come back and I say, judge, before you tell us who's going to be on the jury, I have one more thing I have to put on the record. Well, why is that? And I said, well, judge, I just need to put this one thing on the record. And he says, well, okay, Mr. Swafford. And I said, judge, I had to use one of my peremptory strikes on juror number 7. And as a result of that, I was not able to use it on juror number 46, who was an objectionable juror to me. And then they'll go, okay. And so, because I think some of the judges don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And it's real important in terms of that timing, because if you wait until they're seated, well, you're sort of cheating, mm-hmm. right? Like you could make up that well, I would have used it on this person that ended up on the jury, right?
Right, right.
So that's just one of those things that I handle that is very strongly law-based. And I was on a pretrial this morning with a judge on a very high profile case. And I was saying, you know, judge, I think it would be a good idea for us before trial to have a discussion about what actually is a strike for cause and what it isn't. And sort of in the older days, like if you had a very established judge, they might be a little offended by that to say that, well, I know what the law is on voir dire. And says, well, judge, so this is a very notorious person. And because of how notorious they are, we need to get clear that just because most people we think are not going to like him, that doesn't constitute a strike for cause. And the judge understood that and made it clear that they understood that. And so it was probably a necessary conversation. But sometimes rolling into trial and talking with appellate counsel and doing a little bit of education beforehand can actually be helpful. The other conversation we had this morning was in all of these post-pandemic cases, we've asked for and gotten, with the one exception, an alternate juror. So when you get an alternate juror, both sides, if you get up to two alternate jurors, each side gets an additional peremptory strike. And so judges are all over the map as to how they do that. I mean, there are some judges who say, and I sort of like this, I'm not going to argue with them, even though it's not really how it's done. They'll say, use your 7 any way you want. And well, that's great. And then other judges will say, well, use your six within the strike zone, the first 24 who aren't struck, then your peremptory, like in the next four, assuming you have two alternates. Well, what if there's a double strike? So really the preferable way to do it is to have everybody do their peremptory strikes, their six peremptory strikes, turn those in, then find out where, okay, who is the next four? Where does it go in case you're double strikes or somebody didn't use all their strikes? And then after those next four, then you get to use your peremptory strikes. They'll give you like a minute, right? Okay, the next four, who is it going to be? And so that's actually the proper way. But like really, like a lot of people will say, oh, you do psychology or read people's minds or something like that. But really a lot of what I do is I'm just listening to the words that come out of people's mouths and then putting that together with the law. Mm-hmm.
Again, not all that unlike what appellate lawyers do sometimes.
Yes. Well, you know, it's interesting. I was just at the American Society of Trial Consultants meeting in Denver. And for the most part, other trial consultants aren't lawyers. Most of them are PhDs. And there was a big discussion about some states' moves to get rid of peremptory strikes. And so Arizona has already done that. They've gotten rid of, there are no peremptory strikes in Arizona. And they were sort of in a panic about that. Like, you know, what are we good for if we can't advise people as to how to use their peremptory strikes? Now, you know, my view is as well, maybe you could learn a law and know how to get somebody struck for cause, right?
Right.
And that's a problem you run into if you get advice from people who don't actually know what the law is. And that's where you really need an appellate lawyer. If you've hired somebody to advise the team who is not a lawyer, you really need an appellate lawyer to really step up. Because I've been in rooms where there'll be 10 lawyers and there'll be like another consultant and they'll say, we should ask this question. And I don't want to shame anybody, but it's like, no, that's an improper commitment question. You cannot ask that question.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge. Before we jump too much farther down the road, that's all super fascinating. You're teaching me things I didn't know, which happens so often on the show. But one thing that was revealed to me, given your explanation just now, was just how much strategy goes in and what kind of room there is for strategic decision-making at the voir dire stage of a case. As appellate lawyers, we're thinking about strategy issues too, but they're largely focused on what the law is and how it applies and what might best persuade this particular judge or how are we going to set this up for the Court of Appeals. I love the idea that in the next case you and I work on together, that I can count on you to handle that kind of error preservation issue, because I have to admit, I mean, that's a little out of my wheelhouse. That's not something I'm an expert in. And I'm just glad to know that you're there and you've thought about all of this. And in fact, now I've made it your career, which I was curious before we move on from that too much, just how it is you were a trial lawyer and handled cases firsthand. How did you transition from doing that kind of work? Because you're a full-time jury consultant these days.
Yes. So here's how I say, first of all, I want to let you know that next time we work together, we're going to be collaborating on all of it. Because that's the great thing about having an appellate lawyer is like, hey, listen, I think we need to be prepared for a Batson challenge, given the issues on this case. Or I'm afraid that they're going to try to make a Batson challenge on us. I don't make decisions based on race because it's stupid. Demographics are the least likely predictor of how somebody's going to behave on a jury. And so if you have an opportunity to actually ask questions of people, you should do that, not make decisions based on stereotypes. But oftentimes you have to go look at it. And Voidire is an all hands on deck team sport. If I have an appellate lawyer on my team, then we're enlisting them at the very beginning. So in terms of like how this came to be is that in terms of my career is that I was trying cases using the Cat Bennett method. And the Cat Bennett method was asking questions, how do you feel about personal injury damages? Or how do you feel about the burden of proof? Or how do you feel about someone's failure to testify? And then getting information. And that was like, great. All of a sudden, I was really smart in how I was exercising my peremptory strikes. And Robert Hirschhorn was married to Cat Bennett and really carried on that tradition. And Lisa Blue, very similar, where they ask, they get people talking, they get information. And then what was happening to me is that I was getting all these people to talk and I was getting all this information and I'd get back in the jury room to exercise my 6 peremptory strikes or in a criminal case, my 10 peremptory strikes and realize, man, if I had 30 peremptory strikes, I'd have half a chance. But I didn't. Not with all the tort reformers out there and all the people who already think your client's guilty. And, you know, like I didn't have a chance, right? And so I started to develop questions that were specifically designed to get people struck for cause. And then at some point, I think I gave a speech like 20 years ago to CATLA. And a lawyer asked me, hey, can I hire you to help me pick a jury? And I said, sure. And I think he gave me like a gift coupon. And then and then wanted to hire me some more. And then at some point, I got hired by Pete Ferraro, you know, who's not with us anymore, who's one of the great, great trial lawyers. And then we got some $1 million verdicts. And then I was in the paper. But the thing that actually allowed me to transition to only doing consulting was, believe it or not, family law cases. And so what had happened is I had been hired to pick a jury on a family law case, and they asked me if I could work with a client in terms of witness prep. And I said, well, I think I have some tools that could be helpful on that. And so I did some witness prep. This is sort of a notorious case where our client had told her husband that the child was dead when the child was fine. And that conversation was recorded and then had testified badly about it 4 times. And by the time she testified at the case that I worked with her on, a very, very powerful divorce lawyer asked her, ma'am, you told your husband your child was dead, didn't you? And she said, yes. And I am so sorry. I cannot imagine what that was like for you. The only thing I can promise you is that I will never pull a stunt like that again, and did it from her heart and authentically. And Judge Dietz at the time said, best coached witness I've ever seen. And then that became a substantial part of my work, is doing witness preparation in all kinds of cases, but in a lot of them in high conflict, high value divorce cases. Because I don't know if you know this, Todd, do you know why cannibals will not eat divorced people?
I detect a joke in here, but no, I don't.
Because they're bitter. Now, you should know the answer to the next one is do you know why divorces cost so much?
Because of the lawyers.
Because they're worth it.
Oh. Okay. You got me.
And so at this point, I've picked juries or done witness prep, really any kind of case you can try in front of a judge, jury, or arbitrator. I mean, catastrophic injury cases on both sides, medical malpractice, probate cases, which you talk about law, my gosh, high profile political trials, white collar crime, murder cases, pretty much any kind of case that you can pick a jury on, I've done that. And always appreciate it. Always appreciate when I have an appellate lawyer on the team.
We do too.
Especially when you get to Batson issues.
Absolutely. Yeah. And those come up more frequently than you think. I mean, that doesn't mean they'll be successful, but they do come up fairly often.
What I would say is they don't come up as much as they should. Mm. Like there are so many times, you know, especially civil lawyers won't be thinking about it when they should. I've been in situations where it's clear that everybody knows Batson, but is trying to get around it. So do y'all know who John Wiley Price is?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Dallas County Commissioner.
Yes, that's right. And one of the reasons that if you were to ask John Wiley Price why he's still a Dallas County Commissioner is that he would give some credit to me. Not all, but some. At the beginning of his 7.5-week corruption trial, where the United States government was trying to put him away, the U.S. attorney understood that he couldn't just strike black people. Like, he understood that he couldn't do that. So what he did is, during voir dire, he would call in juror number two. Some people just simply couldn't find someone guilty on circumstantial evidence alone. How do you feel about that? Oh my gosh, I don't think I could find somebody guilty on circumstantial evidence alone. And well, juror number seven, how do you feel about that? Oh, I don't think I could do that either. 14, what do you think about that? Juror 48, what do you think about that? And then juror 48 says, listen, everyone can see what you're doing. And he says, I don't know what you're talking about. She says, we can see what you're up to. He says, well, I'm not up to anything except trying to find out about you. And she says, you're calling on black women. And she was a black attorney. Yeah, she's a black woman. And she says, I'm an attorney and I understand the difference between circumstantial evidence and direct evidence. And yes, I can follow the law. So what he was doing is that since he knew that he couldn't obviously strike African-Americans from the panel, what he was doing was going through and trying to get them struck for cause. And then the judge steps in and the judge says, well, I'd like to talk about the difference between direct evidence and circumstantial evidence and snowy field, no footprints in the snow. You go to sleep the next morning and there are footprints in the snow. Does that help anybody? And then he just went right back to it, right? And then I don't do this often in cases, but there are some cases that I just stand up and do part of the voir dire. Since I'm a lawyer, I've made an appearance. Mm-hmm. And I always do the questioning at the bench and argue the structure cause of the bench. But this is a situation where I just stood up and did a part of the voir dire. And I did a part of the voir dire. And then I said, juror number two, suppose we use the judge's example and there was blood in one of those footprints. And someone took a sample from that blood and sent it to a DNA lab. And it came back and there's DNA evidence. Could you use DNA evidence to find someone guilty? Yes, absolutely. Well, that's circumstantial evidence. So if it were good circumstantial evidence, you could find someone guilty on circumstantial evidence alone, couldn't you? Yes, 14, 28, 48, and rehabilitated everybody. And he made another run at him one by one, but still was not in that situation. And so the thing is that we were able to keep him from getting around Batson by being able to explain the law in such a way that the citizens could understand it. So really, like, the law is fundamental to all of this.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And obviously, like, strategy. And you know what their strategy was? Their strategy was they didn't use their peremptory strikes, hoping they wouldn't get back to juror 48. But it was a 7.5-week trial with 6 alternates, and she ended up on the jury.
Wow.
The person had called him out.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
You know, Robert, it's like we've said before between me and you. I mean, I can sit and listen to you tell stories all day long because this is stuff that just doesn't happen in my world. And it's super interesting to me to hear those details. I wanted to make sure, because I heard something you said that surprised me a little. And a lot of times, over times that we've worked together, we haven't always been in the courtroom at the same time. So I haven't had the privilege of seeing you work as often as I would like to, even though we've worked on the same case. But so you kind of mentioned that your role in the courtroom most of the time is you're watching and observing. And then if you get to actually having to call a potential juror up to examine them, that's where you really, I mean, you're consulting and moving all the pieces around at various times during the voir dire bit. It sounds like where you really speak up is when there's a bench conference.
That's correct. So like, if you sort of take it all the way back, I'll do focus groups and we'll use the focus groups to get us information so that we can write good voir dire questions. And then I'll do witness prep to make sure that our witnesses are in good shape. And as a part of doing witness prep, you want to make sure you know what's in the motion in limine and what's not in the motion in limine and what's hearsay. And like in collaborating with the team about what's coming in and what's not coming in, and make sure that we don't open up the door in terms of questioning. So that's what I'm saying in terms of team approaches, right? Mm-hmm. And then I write scripts for the lawyers to essentially read, but read them in a conversational way. And when we're asking the questions, there are two things that are important in asking a strike for cause question. The first thing is you want to make it easy for the person to say yes. And then the second thing is you want the yes to have legal significance. You want it to actually be a strike for cause. So I've given an example before about mental anguish, but there are many cases where we'll have non-English speakers as clients. Well, you can't say to the panel, I guess you could say to the panel, there wouldn't be anything that would stop you under the law, but it wouldn't be very effective. Would all the racists please raise their hands? Get your cards up. I mean, maybe a few hands, because we are in a different age, but it's not going to get everybody. But you can ask the question, people have strong feelings about testimony that comes through interpreters. There are some people who would be able to consider testimony that comes through an interpreter to be just as credible as testimony that had come through English. There are other people who would just not be able to give the same credibility to testimony that came through an interpreter as if the person had spoken the testimony in English. Which of these best describes you? Well, I'm in that second category. I wouldn't be able to trust something that came through interpreter. Tell me about that, because you want something in their own words, right? Well, if someone's not speaking English, that makes me think that they're not here legally. And what are they doing? Filing a lawsuit if they're not here legally? That's like someone breaking and burglarizing my home and then suing me because they got hurt. Well, so is it fair to say that you would just not be able to give that the same credibility to testimony that came through a translator? Is that fair to say? Yes, it's fair to say. Who agrees? But it's really important to understand not just that the question is worded in such a way that you get a yes, but also that it has legal significance. And oftentimes, I'll have a question that says, is it fair to say that regardless of the law, the facts, or the judge's instructions, you simply couldn't do X, Y, or Z? You want it nailed down in the record. Mm. Now, I didn't say, is it fair to say with the law, the facts, or the judge's instructions? If I said it like that, the person's going to back up and say, well, I don't know about the law. But what the court reporter wrote down was the law, the facts, and the judge's instructions. All right. Mm-hmm. So throughout this process, you want to make sure that you're working with the appellate team and understand what you're doing actually is going to protect the record. That if you ask for a strike for cause, you actually got one. And also, you want to work with the appellate team about the motion in limine. Mm-hmm. Like if you know, if you've done some reconnaissance and you know the other side does certain things in voir dire that you think are questionable, then you want to get with the appellate team and say, hey, listen, we need to get this in the motion in limine. Or you want to make sure there's not something in the motion in limine that's going to prevent you from doing something that you need to do. Mm-hmm. And one of the things people ask me is, do you ever use demonstratives in voir dire? And I never do that. And the reason I never do that is because when I walk into a courtroom, I ask the other side, are you going to use demonstratives? And oftentimes now they'll say, yes. Well, I get to see them. Show me your demonstratives. So I know what their voir dire is before they start. And then before they start, I'll go to the judge. I say, judge, I have real concerns about this slide. I think they're going to use the golden rule with this slide. They're going to violate the golden rule. And the judge said, was that what you're going to do with this slide? No. What are you going to do? Well, I'm going to ask this. Well, that's a violation of the golden rule, Judge. I mean, I've cut people off at the knees before they ever got to say a word.
Wow. That's a lot of stuff that goes into, I mean, I admire your commitment to what you do, Robert, and just the depth of knowledge that you really have to do it effectively. You're talking about not only having to blend the law into what you do, but the way you ask questions, and I guess this really kind of dovetails into the whole strike for cause method, is I believe you touched upon it earlier when you said what you really want to do is ask questions of folks and get them to answer things in their own words. Mm-hmm. So the way that you're able to fit that together, and then at the end of this process, it spits out, you've made your challenges, I mean, you've made your strikes for cause, you've made your peremptory challenges, and at the end of the day, you've got 12 people sitting in the box.
Yes. And the thing is that the nature of being human is to be biased and prejudiced and have no insight into the fact that you're biased and prejudiced. And that's the human condition. And so you only get a certain number of peremptory strikes. Mm-hmm. And so the thing is that the only way you can really influence a trial very much is to get rid of the people who are bad for you through strikes for cause. And I've had cases where I've had 75 people strike for cause, but they're not random people. They're people who are bad for me. So that's the important thing is you right. want the people who are good for you to keep their mouth shut. But in that same case, I had a very good Harris County judge who had basically threatened me if I'd burn the panel. And I said, I'm not going to burn the panel. But the lawyer for the other side had not read Cortez. And so he got up and he said, well, you're going to learn. And if you were to do that, would you? And then I stood up and I said, objection, that's an improper commitment question. And the judge says, sustained. And then the lawyer looked sort of confused. This is like a 40-year lawyer, tried hundreds of cases in his career. And he stood up and he started another question. And then I stood up and said, by the way, I handle the objections during voir dire as well. And I said, objection, improper commitment question. And the judge said, sustained. And then he said, well, if you were to hear about a case that, and then started to do the exact facts of the case, try to make it hypothetical, right? And I said, wow. Objection, Mr. Swofford, I've got it. And he says, counselor, this is the third time. This is in front of a panel of 100.
Ouch.
Counselor, this is the third time that you've asked an improper commitment question. And if the next question you have is not a proper question, then I'm going to end your time for voir dire. I'm going to assume you don't have any proper questions. I'm going to end your time for voir dire. It's in front of a panel of 100 people. And he didn't have any proper questions. So he just looked down at the chart and said, well, juror number 3, I see you're a plumber. How do you like being a plumber? I mean, just basically had to make conversation for a while.
Oh, wow.
And so that's what I'm saying is that, I mean, I keep saying this, the law is critical in all of this. It is a combination of personal skills, being able to be with people, asking good questions, writing good questions, being able to listen well. There are all those skills involved. But if you don't know the law of voir dire, then you're at sea. You're just sort of flailing. And a lot of times you'll sort of look and see, does the person really have any strategy at all? Or do they just think this is like an inquiry into the truth? No, this isn't like an academic forum discussion. This is us trying to win the case. And in order to do that, you have to know, like, not only just how do you preserve your error, but what's a proper question? What's an improper question? And recently I had a case where my entire strategy was to keep the other side from burning the panel because I knew what I would do if I were on the other side.
No, and I was going to ask you, I assume that there are circumstances in which you would actually want to burn the panel. Or as you say, your objective in that case was to not permit the other side to burn the panel. But because of that, that being your objective, was it because you had taken a look at the entire veneer and said, we're going to get a good 12 jurors out of this?
Okay, so I rarely talk about my losses, okay? And you just let you know, I've won most of my 22 post-vaccination and I've got some big verdicts. Okay. They were not. And this is one of those lessons I learned from my losses, right? This was a case where I felt like in that particular county, the facts were so much in our favor that we just had to have a trial, right?
Yeah.
And we had not done focus groups on the case. And I'm not going to give the style of the case to the county because there probably are some appeals that are going to be done on this, but basically involved a Russian oligarch on the other side. And I thought with our current situation, or at least a relative of a Russian oligarch, with our current situation in terms of Russia and Ukraine, and just sort of background, that as long as I ceded, and I got about 7 strikes for cause, right? But I wasn't pushing. I was trying to hold onto the panel. But if I, as long as I ceded a jury, we'd win. And so I utterly and completely frustrated the other side in objecting to their questions. And that's one where we had prepared to breathe. So the judge really knew what I was doing. And they could not form a proper question that would get a strike for cause, even though they were representing a relative of a Russian oligarch and it was relevant in the case, right? Now, the problem that I ran into there is that, remember I said that the nature of being human is to be biased and prejudiced and have no insight into the fact that you're biased and prejudiced. So who all does that apply to? Just the jurors or to me also? So that was my bias. And so I was just trying to hold on to people. I wasn't really hard trying to get rid of people.
Yeah.
But I don't watch Tucker Carlson. And so I was probably missing something in terms of there being people who don't think Russia's that bad right now. Mm-hmm. And we weren't in Travis County. We were probably one of the most conservative counties in Texas, right? And so I was probably blinded in that situation by my own biases. And so that's something that I'm always involved in an inquiry about, because am I wanting to strike this person because I don't like them personally? Or am I wanting to strike this person because they're bad for the case? Or am I not considering striking this person because I like them so much, but they're terrible for my case? It's like, oh, well, and then there are other biases. Like one of the big verdicts we got is a $44 million verdict against Hilton in a civil sexual assault case with Michelle Tugel as the lawyer. She's a star, right? Mm-hmm. And 90% on Hilton. Well, in that case, you ask your question, well, are sexual assault victims on the panel good for us or bad for us? Well, your automatic would be yes, if you're representing a sexual assault victim in a civil sexual assault case, you want sexual assault victims on your jury, right? Well, that's obvious and wrong, okay? Some sexual assault victims are great for you. Some are the worst jurors you could have. Mm-hmm. And so you have to be able to ask questions and inquire into that, but also ongoingly, never stop looking at, okay, where are my biases coming into play here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an impressive feat of self-realization.
It is.
You know, to be able to acknowledge your own, but yet I think you're right. It seems like it would be critical to be able to do it effectively.
I think to one of your earlier points, so much about jury selection always kind of has relied on sort of these stereotypes, but they're not accurate. And so you have to see through that and really think about who's sitting there and what they're saying. It matters so much more than just trying to point to characteristics and say, oh, they'll be a good juror or a bad juror, because you have no idea unless you ask the questions.
And it's also illegal.
Right. Well, but I don't even mean just race necessarily, but just in general, just drawing our teachers or engineers, mm-hmm. good or bad for a particular side. Well, the answer is who knows in any particular case.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you get an opportunity to ask these individual human beings questions.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so like, if that's all I had, then yeah, I'd make decisions based on demographics if that's all I had. But most of the time, even in federal court, a lot of times they're letting us use supplemental written questionnaires, or the judges will allow us to submit questions for the judge to ask. And some of the judges, like, Judge Akel, if you send him a good question that's clean, he'll ask it the way it's written, right? Judge Pittman, the same way. I mean, a lot of these federal judges, they have to be clean, right? They can't be weighted one way or the other. But if you send them good questions, they'll consider them. I don't know if y'all have heard this, but Waco is now a hotbed of intellectual property litigation. And since I went to Baylor undergrad and Baylor Law School, and I've spoken at the law school like twice a year to every practice court class for the past 15 years, all the local counsels are calling me whenever these cases get set for trial. And so recently I picked a jury in, I think it's Judge Mazant, and he gave each side 15 minutes of attorney voir dire, but then would allow you to follow up with each person. Well, we wrote 15 questions and they were good questions, but the way the process worked in his courtroom is you ask the questions and you would just have people raise their cards. And so we certainly used all 15 minutes, right? And then we were able to follow up afterwards one by one. And he did a pretty good voir dire himself. Well, the lawyer for the other side on this intellectual property case stood up when it was his time to do his 15 minutes, said, well, I just feel like the judge did such a good job that I'm only going to ask one question. That is there anything you didn't cover? You were given this jewel, this gift to actually address and talk to the jury, and you didn't do anything. These are huge cases. And so the thing is, I mean, I do feel like in these areas, like a lot of times in business litigation business litigation or intellectual property litigation or commercial fraud, those kinds of cases, the lawyers aren't as attuned to how important it is. Now, you ask a plaintiff's lawyer or a criminal defense lawyer, you know, or a prosecutor how important voir dire is, they may or may not know how to do it well, but they sure know it's important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing I wanted to ask you about was, as we all know, things kind of went crazy in March of 2020, and our jury trials shut down in all really the most rural counties in Texas. How did you manage to pivot your practice during that time, you know, when we had no jury trials going on?
I was really lucky in that I already had teams of people I work with and doing focus groups. I work and also doing visuals. So there's a woman named Sherry Worth who has the exhibit company, who is just like the best doing visuals, you know, doing demonstratives. And then I have a person I work with named Angel Granados, who does our day in the life films and would do the audiovisual. He's on faculty at UCLA in their film department.
Wow.
So I had this ready-made team. I'm not somebody who's necessarily in a position where I'm good at technology, but I had these people who are available. So for example, I happen to have like a light like that.
Oh, yeah. And you can't see it, but he's got basically a studio light. Robert has a studio light.
And this is on something that allows me to adjust the height so that the height is just right. And it's about an arm's length. I got all this coaching. So that was early on, is I had the team. And then there's a lawyer that I work with a lot in Houston named Rob Ammons. And a lot of lawyers just said, hey, listen, why should we do focus groups or do witness prep or depositions if we don't know when we're going to go to trial? And Rob said, we're going to put all these cases in a box and had them ready to take them off the shelf whenever the courtrooms open back up. And so he said, Robert, can you do a virtual focus group? I said, absolutely, we can do that. And we'd never done one before, but with Sherry and Angel, we got to where we could do those very well. And I had already been doing Zoom witness prep because I live in Austin and all these tech people, right? And the tech people before the pandemic, when I would say, well, when are you going to bring your team down for me to work with them to get them ready to testify? They say, we're not doing that. I said, well, are you going to fly me to Cleveland and Seattle and LA? And they said, no, we're not going to do that, Robert. We're going to do Zoom. And I'd never heard of Zoom except the TV show. Remember the show? Come on and zoom, 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 I zoom. We're gonna zoom, I zoom, I zoom, I zoom. My favorite TV show when I was a kid. So anyways, I had already been doing Zoom. And what I will tell you is post-pandemic, we still have lawyers who are saying, hey, listen, can you do the Zoom focus groups? We still do virtual focus groups because we can see people well, we can hear them, we get good information from it. You know, I mean, we're doing in-person focus groups too, but that's something that stayed through. And of course, Zoom witness prep has stayed in. And I started pushing Zoom trials, much to the chagrin of my fellow lawyers.
Right.
Because they hated it, even though one of my biggest supporters is Mike Doyle down in Houston. And he really argued against it and then got a huge verdict and won. I won the argument, but he got the $7 million verdict. But I refused to show up in court until I got vaccinated, unless the judge had both a JD and a PhD in public health or an MD. And that never happened. So I prepped some people. We had a couple of Roku cases that went to trial in Waco and a few places, but it wasn't until I was vaccinated. And then once I got vaccinated, I picked four juries in the NRG Center in Houston, which is where they have the rodeo with headphones and microphones and face masks and spread out like stadium seating. So I did four of those. And then the last one I did those, I took a picture of myself and posted on Facebook and said, not my first rodeo. And then I did a Zoom trial. I did a couple of trials in federal court where everyone was required to be vaccinated, which raises some interesting appellate points in terms of, does that give you a jury of your peers? Does that affect the panel? Panel composition.
Yeah.
And so I did a couple of those. And then all the rest of them were in places where COVID didn't exist, like Big Spring, Texas, and Tyler, Texas, and Waco, Texas, and Georgetown, Texas, and Springfield, Missouri, and Tyler, Texas, and Brazoria County, and Fort Bend County, like all these places where there really was no COVID, right?
Not necessarily the most remote locations, as I was suggesting earlier.
I would walk into the courtroom and be the only person wearing a mask on my side of the bar. Like none of the lawyers, none of the judge, none of the staff wearing a mask.
Wow.
And it, just a smattering of the panel. Some of these counties where there are 37%, 36% vaccination rates. And the judges in all those counties, I would often hear this. This is our first in-person trial. This is our first trial back. So I had lots of those. And then the judge would say, this is our first trial back. And so if there's anyone who's worried about COVID, then I just want to let you know, you're excused. No questions asked. No questions asked. And I'm going to further tell you that we're not going to like follow you home and make sure that you're not out at the grocery store or anything. We're going to take you at your word. Okay. So anybody has a concern, raise your number card right now and you can go.
Wow.
Yeah, at the beginning of the void hour. So how many people in these rural counties do you think raised their card? Do you want to guess a number?
Zero.
I don't think very many.
Zero is a number, and that would be correct. Yeah, zero. Which does not mean that they weren't trying to get off of jury duty for all kinds of lame reasons. Like, oh, I've got to pick up my child from school. How old's your child? We're 16. I've got to pick up my wedding dress on Thursday. And like all kinds of lame excuses of people trying to get off juries, but would not do the get out of jail free card. So that was one of the things that was like really telling and not surprising, because one of the things that we know, and it's the reason it's really important and hard to craft a good strike for cause question, is that people are wired to look good and avoid looking bad. And so the more technical term for that is people give socially desirable answers. And so in those counties, if someone said that I'm afraid of COVID, you would be shunned by your community. So they could not say that. They could say anything else, but they couldn't say that in a big group setting.
Wow.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we're kind of reaching the end. This has been great. And our tradition at the end is always to ask for a tip or a war story. And you've given us plenty of both, but I don't know if you have anything that you want to wrap up with.
I'm thinking in terms of war stories. I just keep telling war stories, right?
Yeah, you got a bunch of them.
Well, here's a tip. Find out everything you can find out about where you're going, okay? And how things are done. Not just the local rules, because there are all kinds of things that aren't in the local rules. And this is both a tip and a war story, okay? So I have like a checklist. If you're going to federal court, is there attorney voir dire? If you're not allowed to do attorney voir dire, can you do a supplemental written questionnaire? If you can't do a supplemental written questionnaire, can you submit questions to the judge? What are the deadlines on those? Mm-hmm. In any courtroom, how's the judge going to handle strikes for cause? Is the judge just going to rule based on what was said down in the panel? Are you going to be able to question them further at the bench? How are they going to handle rehabilitation? Do you need to inoculate for rehabilitation if it's going to be a particularly bad actor judge? So have your checklist. How do they handle hardship? Are there numbered cards for the jurors to hold up? I always bring a set of laminated number cards. So juror number one has a card that says one. So find out everything you can find out. How much time are you going to get to exercise your peremptory strikes? If you're in Judge Moyer's court in Dallas, the answer to that question is 5 minutes and his bailiff is knocking on the door at four. And so just as much as you can find out. So now I'm going to tell a war story about that. So I'm upstairs in a courtroom in a county that I probably shouldn't mention the name of the county because I'm picking juries there a lot. Okay, Fort Bend. And I'm upstairs and I'm going through my checklist. And I say, so Judge, how do you handle hardship? And he says, oh, we have our special way of doing that. I said, well, the reason I'm asking is, do we need to ask the hardship questions or does the court handle that? He says, oh, we handle it, right? And the next question I says, well, where are we actually going to pick the jury? And it says, oh, downstairs in the jury assembly room, because they're trying to have some COVID protections. So I go downstairs and there are people lined up getting reassigned. And like an associate judge downstairs listening to people up at the bench. And I thought to myself, there is no way that there are this many people who are over the age of 75 or have a child under a certain age that will be left without care or can't read or speak the English language or has a disability such that they can't participate or don't live in the county. Like, she's doing something more than qualifying, right? Because this is just too many people who are being cut loose. Well, what she was doing was hearing hardship without any of the lawyers being there. And I realize what's going on. I rush upstairs. I get the other lawyers. I say, Judge, listen, there's somebody down there cutting people loose because they have a cruise scheduled or they have a procedure at the hospital, which I may or may not agree to, probably would agree to on what they're doing. But you can't do that. For a hardship or an economic excuse, it requires both parties and the judge to agree. And I'm not agreeing. And he says, well, where is that in the law? And I thought, well, everybody just knows this.
Oh, no.
And I said, does somebody have a code of criminal procedure here? I started to flip through it. And all that, all the while, people are being cut loose, right? Oh, yeah, that whole time. And so then we get down there. And so now I'm on the phone. Who am I on the phone to, Todd?
You're on the phone talking to your appellate lawyer.
Yes, I'm on the phone to every appellate lawyer I know.
That's right.
Seeing who will pick up because they didn't have an appellate lawyer there.
Oh, no.
The team didn't have an appellate lawyer there for voir dire. So I'm calling every appellate lawyer I know saying, what do I do? And so they said, well, ask for more peremptory strikes or ask to drag them all back in. to find out what the basis was. So I asked for those, denied. And I asked for 88 peremptory strikes, denied, for everybody to think cut loose. I don't know how to preserve error on that.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, that's a tough one.
And so now what you have to do is you have to know before you go into the county how they do things. I began my objection with, Judge, I want to begin with, I'm not from around here.
Usually that's not a good thing to say.
And that's why I don't know. But here's the thing that's interesting about this. In terms of an appellate question, so I have these two appellate lawyers, how does one appeal or preserve error if a judge grants a strike for cause that they should not have? If someone had not clearly exhibited bias, if somebody had not said anything that would indicate that they should be struck for cause, how does one preserve error in that situation? It's a trick question. And I saw an appellate lawyer on the other side of a case. They did bring appellate counsel. There were like five defendants, you know, in this case. And you could tell he was utterly frustrated by the fact that I had cleared out so much of the panel. Mm. And so he was saying, well, Judge, we should get additional peremptory strike. Well, that's not a cure. Because what that's a cure if the judge didn't strike someone who should have been struck. But I think, and I haven't seen any cases on this, but I think if a judge strikes somebody that they should not have struck, then there's no harm as long as you have 12 people who are a fair and impartial jury. Because you're not entitled to a favorable jury, you're only entitled to a fair and impartial jury. And so I sort of like want to subtly inject that whenever a judge is on the fence about something to say, you know, Judge, we have a panel of 100. We got plenty of jurors. We're not going to bust the panel today. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to be overruled for granting something.
I like that. That's a great one. Well, Robert, thanks for spending time with us today. We really appreciate it. We just learned so much, and it's great to compare what you do to what we do. And it really helps me to understand the jury selection process even more.
I'm obviously such a law nerd whenever it comes to this. I'm a voir dire nerd. And it is hard to have people who will, and certainly not my wife, although she's great with me, but she's pretending. And I feel with you guys that, yeah, y'all are getting it. Yeah, yeah, this is great. This is cool, interesting stuff. Because it is cool, interesting stuff that we do. And really, so I look forward to working with both y'all in the future.
Thanks very much.
Well, likewise. Thanks again.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.